Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the Yes Indeed podcast created by Mark Shepherd and now run by me, Thomas Manuel. Buckle up, folks, because it's a big one today. It's got a quite apropos title. This is 1.5 hours of hardcore RPG theory. Sydney and I have a lot of fun talking about theory in the beginning and then applying that to analyze one of their games. It's a very nerdy conversation. There aren't a lot of places to have a conversation like the one that we just had. I think it's good GameScript. If you like GameScript, like this episode. But before we get to the interview, I want to thank my patrons who support me. And today, I think for the first time, I have an ad read. I have an ad submitted by one of my patrons at the $15 producer level. Support me at that level. You get one free ad read. And that's what's happening now. Rio de Janeiro at the end of the 19th century is a city of slums and palaces, street gangs and tycoons, magic charms and outlawed martial arts. Created by Thomas McGrenery, based on the award-winning drama system designed by Robin D. Laws, Malandros is an RPG where you play residents of Rio in those tumultuous times. Gang leaders, captains of industry, fishermen, martial artists, swindlers and more. You all know each other, your family, friends, rivals or enemies all living in the same neighborhood. And you all want something from each other. Maybe it's respect, maybe it's love, maybe it's something else. But will you get what you want? That's what we play to find out. Malandros is available in print and PDF from Porcupine Publishing on DriveThruRPG. Check it out. Was that good? Did I read the thing well? Anyway, thanks to everybody who listens to these shows. Thanks to everybody who supports me on Patreon. I really, really appreciate it. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this awesome interview. And I'll catch you on the other side. I'm sitting down today with Sydney Icarus. Sydney is a game designer of, among other things, the sci-fi horror game Decaying Orbit, published by Story Brewers Roleplaying, which won the 2023 ARPIA Game of the Year Award. But I first heard of them as the fantastic host of the now-concluded Hard Move, a wonderful podcast where every episode, Sydney and a guest analyzed one move from a PBTA game. A real loss for GameScript when it sadly came to an end. But the same scholarly mindset continues in projects that Sydney does today, like the Daily Blade blog, where they work through the text for Blades in the Dark, page by page, studying it and reacting to it. And Action Paths, a framework that Sydney developed to analyze how people interact with games of all kinds. So, Sydney, thanks for being here. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
G'day. Thank you for such kind words about me and the Hard Move, which I also miss. I really appreciate it. And I'm doing fantastically. It's a beautiful day here in Toronto, and I'm vibing.
Yeah. So my first question, Sydney, is in the Hard Move, which I've listened to every episode of it, you started every episode by describing yourself as an RPG descriptivist. What does that mean?
Yeah. So there are two schools of thought around language. One, around like linguistics specifically. One is that we should study how language is used in the community and that language is a tool that people bring to bear to communicate with each other. And the other is that we should study how language should be used, or like how language is intended to be used and what words are meant to mean. And that what I'm going to call like deviant usage is a detraction from the clarity and specificity of language. And these two schools were called descriptivism and prescriptivism. And so I started originally, because I didn't have the words for it, I started calling myself an RPG descriptivist, because what I really cared about was what things looked like at the table, not what they were in the book, or at least when doing something like the Hard Move, which is studying text, it was about how does this text bring a certain experience to the players at the table.
On your website, waxwings.au, you describe your goal as to make games that remember their role as an invitation to play. Like that's the quote, remember their role as an invitation to play. And it seems like there's a problem here, kind of unstated sort of problem statement that you're responding to in your design, in your analysis, in your writing about games. How would you articulate the problem that kind of your work seems to circle around?
This is such a fascinating question. I think there is an unstated problem in game design, and specifically in the space that we would call like serious games, games designed to like team build or build change or alter behavior, which is that like that games are a tool that we bring to bear on top of people. This is like Skinner box theory and like Luke Gearing's against incentives theory, the idea that like games are a way to compel, and like using that word really intentionally, like a way to extract behavior from people. And the three keywords for Waxwings as a game design and game design consulting company was always agency, feedback, and delight. The idea that that games are about giving people options to make choices, that those choices provide consequence within the game, which is the feedback, and that the experience of making a choice and experiencing the consequence of that choice is delightful. Not specifically like fun, not specifically joyful, but delightful, evocative of like the human experience in some way. And I was just experiencing at the time when I wrote that, which was kind of in the late 20-teens, I was experiencing a lot of games that were committed to hard framing players into positions and then pretending that the player ending up in that position was some, you know, evocative statement on the human condition, when really all it was doing was creating a system that gave players no choice, no way to express anything. And then they would do the thing, and then the game would say, well, aren't we clever for having made you do the thing? And I've just never been about that.
Are you thinking about serious games here, or is this, you know, or are you referring to just whatever, like, what is the opposite of a serious game? the games we play for fun.
Yeah, see, this is, okay, like a little serious games attraction, but there's, yeah. I very rarely use the term serious games now. Yeah. I normally talk about like applied games, because you're right. What's the opposite of serious games is fun, but like serious games can be fun too, and also fun games can not be fun sometimes. So like, and also, you know, fun as a global signifier kind of doesn't mean anything. Like we've talked about the difference between a game as a sense pleasure versus a game as a challenge. Yeah. And like, do we just call those both fun even though they're wholly different experiences? Yeah, so it's not just in serious games. I think there was a period of really late Powered by the Apocalypse games that were committed to using their moves to force players into situations rather than using their moves to entice players into situations.
Okay.
And like one of the hardest things to get across to people when they first start playing Apocalypse World, right, is they say, oh, all these moves are really like confrontational and violent. I don't want to do that. I want to do something nice. And as a new player, you kind of inform them like, that's cool, you're allowed to do that, you're allowed to do something nice, you're allowed to share and engage in community and ask politely. And they say, oh great, well like what dice do I roll to do that? And the answer is, well, like no, you only have authority as a player when you're being terrible, when you're bringing destabilizing violence into the conversation. So like, you can ask nicely, but you can't control me by asking nicely. And so, and this was the core of the hard move, right? Deciding to engage with a move is about saying, I want a very specific outcome and I want to get to it through a very specific, like, fictional direction. And it was the same was true in the serious games at the time, where they were like these really, there was a lot of popular death spiral type games that were like, This you know, military warfare war game, if you get involved in a naval war, you just run out of resources. And then at the end of it, the game says like, well, what did we learn? And the players say, well, naval wars are a waste of resources. And like, that's not a good takeaway. That is the framing of the game that has led you to that conclusion. I think the best example I can give that's like the counter example, defining it through exception, would be something like 10 Candles, Stephen Chu's 10 Candles, which is this game that expressly says, like, at the end of this, you're all going to die. This is the outcome. All of your characters are all going to die. But what actually matters through the act of play is, like, what do we believe in as people? What do we hope for? What are we willing to sacrifice ourselves for? What drives the decisions that we make? And so the game is presenting what looks like a foregone conclusion, but actually letting you explore quite a lot and get away from this idea that, like, a game is a set path that a player will travel down until they reach the conclusion that the designer has already decided they should reach.
Yeah, I mean, a game is interesting when the things that are decided are sort of facilitating some kind of like emergent behavior or understanding that is different from the things that were decided, right? Otherwise, I'm just telling you, like, you know, if I, what is the difference with me making a rule that says naval battles are a losing proposition and and just telling you naval battles, you're going to learn it exactly the same amount or exactly the same way, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. Like, that's perfect. I clip that. This should be the thing that gets tweeted out from this, is that there is a functional difference between a player having an emergent experience that is, I'm going to use the word orthogonal, but like that is adjacent to but not directly what was decided.
Yeah.
Which is like, I love that so much, because I agree with you that if we already have conclusions that we're trying to reach, or we just want to express things, we can do that through textbooks and lectures and conversations and all these like learning pedagogies that we kind of already have. But if we want players to explore fresh options, we want them to understand a situation differently, you have to do that by, I guess, like to quote Vincent McGay Baker on it, like you have to make your movement misdirect. You have to come at it from an angle where they're not expecting to see the outcome. Yeah.
And I guess this is, I mean, to loop back to descriptivism, this is the fun part about it, right? Other than avoiding like the flame wars of the internet, which is what all the prescriptivists kind of end up creating, like descriptivism is fun and interesting and useful because you end up seeing the thing that emerges rather than the thing you want to emerge. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the whole thing about descriptivism is that you have to take a step back as a designer. You have to remove your ego as a designer, and you have to stop believing that you know best. You have to believe that other people out there are more interesting than you, more creative than you, have something to say that you don't have to say, and you have to value that. And that's really what descriptivism is about.
Let's talk about this a little bit. You're not saying a specific or precise vision encoded in game mechanics is bad.
No, I'm not, because this is also, I think, like a core part of it. Like, all game design has an opinion. What you choose to design the game about has an opinion. What options you choose to give your players is an opinion. You can't design any sort of abstraction. Like if I'm shooting a documentary with David Attenborough, where I choose to point that camera in the rainforest is an opinion. It's me saying what I believe to be interesting, or what I believe to be dynamic, or what I believe to be part of the storyline that we're telling. So like, there is no way to create any sort of abstraction to edit down any of the human experience without having an opinion about it and professing that opinion. But I think there is a very big difference between offering that opinion as an invitation to discussion, and specifically discussion through play, and offering that opinion as a conclusion.
I think about this a lot, like definitely like in my own design as well, where I'm like, what's the part that I bring, and what's the part that I'm asking the players to bring, and how am I helping them bring the thing that I want them to bring, right?
The way that I really like it expressed is the Story Brewers, my publishers for Decaying Orbit, and the best Australian publishers, but like maybe the best publishers pound for pound in the world. I count myself very lucky to have both like a personal friendship and a business relationship with them. But the Story Brewers talk about it as who says what when. And when we talk about who there, we have to include the system, either because the system is deciding who says it or the system is having something to say in and of itself. And so I think that every time you think about who gets to say this, who gets to decide whether or not their armor piercing bullets can go through bulletproof armor, who gets to decide that is a function of what you believe about the world and like how you want players to explore that belief.
Say a little more about who says what when.
So who says what when? Let's kind of break it down into terms first, and that is, who is the people? It's the question of like, where does the authority lie? Is it the GM? Is it the system? Is it a player? Is it the player to your left? Is it the player who rolled highest? Is it the player who rolled lowest? Says what is their authority? What are they deciding? What are they asserting? And we'll touch a little bit on that in a sec. And then when is under what conditions can they do that? And like what limitations are placed on them? What currencies have to be spent? What restrictions do they have? How does it cross the line? That sort of thing. And then there's kind of an implicit thing on the end, which is like, and why? And that's, and what is the goal of play? And what is like the stated goal of play and also the implicit goal of play? And that's kind of what we're talking about like, you know, Apocalypse World might have a stated goal of play of like, getting resources for your character, but the actual implicit goal of play is like to kind of have fun in a community that is already destabilized. Like that's same with Blades in the Dark, right? Everyone's like, oh, I really want our crew to succeed and become the most well-known, strongest crew in the world. But what you really want is to like hang out with your friends and do some high octane scores. And there's also a very good video on YouTube if you go to the Story Brewers channel where they give a talk on this, which will give you kind of more detail on their approach to it. The question of like how we pass authority around the table is intrinsically linked to like what we're trying to explore and how that exploration occurs. And then the reason for like why do we do this is like why does it matter to consider that? And it's because one, games are kind of designed to be delightful or fun or enjoyable or sense pleasure or game feel or like however you want to use the term, but they're meant to be a delightful experience. And who says what when is a very, very core part of generating a delightful experience at the table because it's how that conversation flows. And the other thing about it is that it contributes to the tone of play and it contributes to like how you want the game to flow. I recently wrote in the Daily Blade that Apocalypse World 2nd Edition is really explicit about like conversations should have people talking over each other and monopolizing, and someone should get really excited about something and assert it, and someone else should just kind of let it happen. And Blades in the Dark is very clear about like, we all work together. This is a consensus building experience. The GM has last say on this, but we all contribute to the decision the GM should be making. The player has last say on this, but we all contribute to the decision the player should be making. This kind of touches on really core RPG theory in the Baker Boss principle, which is Vincent Baker and Emily Kerr Boss, saying that the only thing that system is good for, the only thing that system actually is how you build consensus at the table. How when one player says this happens, another player says this happens, how do you decide which one happens? Because nothing occurs in a role-playing game until everyone at the table agrees that it occurs, either by like active agreement or just by not interrupting and saying, wait, I'm going to invoke a rule, or like, you can't say that. And yeah, so when it comes to like, why is who says what when such a core part of intro game design, it's because it engages both layers. It engages the layer of rules, it engages the layer of like, how do we systemically discuss what happens next in our story? but it also engages with the exogenous layer, the like social layer of play. It also engages with like, how do we make sure that everyone gets to have a say? How do we make sure that we listen to our friends? How do we invoke and call on people and that sort of stuff? And so like, a really core part of the reason that D&D says there are wizards and wizards are good at arcana, there are fighters and fighters are good at athletics, and there are rogues and rogues are good at acrobatics. The reason it says that is because it wants at the table for one player to say, oh, there's magic runes, I use my arcana skill. And the next player to say, and then I run over to the other side using my athletic skill. And then the rogue says, and I sneak through the back using my stealth skill. And like, the reason that niche protection or differentiation or whatever class structure exists in a lot of the games that we play is because it divides up who gets to say something so that we all make sure that we're like getting to contribute in some sort of perceived fair way.
Yeah. And fairness is a decision to be made, yeah?
Right, right. And this goes back to like all games are political, because in Apocalypse World Second Edition, when you go aggro on someone, the person that you threaten violence with, so for people who aren't familiar, which I can't imagine it's too many, but let's do it anyway. Apocalypse World Second Edition has a move called Go Aggro, which is when you tell someone what you want from them and you have an explicit threat behind it, what you're going to do to them if they don't do it, you get to make this move. But the move doesn't say, and then they have to do it. The move gives the person who has been threatened a list of responses, right? So the whole point of that, Thomas, is that A, it creates a nice feeling at the table. I'm not being backed into the corner with a gun in my mouth. I don't feel the social violence in the way that like the game is presenting physical violence. I'm having my options restricted, not being given a mandate or being given, you know, being enforced. That is a better play experience, but it also contributes to the message of like violence is inherently uncontrollable. If you threaten someone with violence, you don't get to choose how they act. You just get to choose if you deliver the violence or not. This is about a concept from Action Paths, or at least using the language that's in Action Paths, which is the published research with the Digital Games Research Association of Australia, about orientation to information, and especially orientation to your strategy set. For players to be able to make a decision, they need to know that what the options available to them are, right? They need to have some sort of tool. And that tool can be a number of things, right? It can be contextual and like experiential. And a really great example of that is the way that a lot of OSR games, especially things calling back to like second edition D&D or basic D&D, the way that those games provide players with option sets is the player has to use their context of what like a D&D is, of what a fantasy adventure is. Of course you can pick the lock because it's D&D and lock picking is a thing that exists. Of course you can cast a magic ritual to summon someone to your location because that's a thing that is present in fantasy games. But if I sat my mum down and said, you know, you and I, let's play through Mothership, right? Very, very famously, Sean McCoy of Mothership has said that I want the game to be about like hiding and running away, and but I didn't put rules in about that because I want players to explore it through discussion. But if you sat down with my mum who has fallen asleep during Alien, who has fallen asleep during Arrival, who has fell asleep during The Matrix, like my mum has never found a sci-fi movie that she can get more than 35 minutes into. If you played Mothership with her and said, you know, so here's the thing, she would look down at her sheet and say, oh, I have a rifle, I start shooting stuff. And Sean McCoy would say, well, no, that's like not the intended path of the game. And it's because the game wants players to use this like this built or developed context. If you play a game like chess, which has distinct moves and very clear rules about who can move where and when and all that sort of stuff, players are really well oriented to it, and it creates this like analytical pathway where they want to process all of their options at once, and then they want to go through those options and like follow them as far as their decision-making brain can take them, assuming what will happen at each outcome. If I move bishop e5, he will do this. And, and then, you know, checkmate in four. But if you take those things off the table, if you take those things away, players can go into more of like a guess and check cycle, or can go into like more of a testing cycle. They're like, but what happens if I push this button? What happens if I hide in a box? What happens if... And how your game like expresses to players what they can expect from that is like a very clear expression of what your game's about or what your game's trying to say.
I think the interesting thing about that, specifically the examples of chess and Mothership, is that Mothership is, the way I see it, coming from a tradition where it's like, yeah, you know, some options are obvious to you. And if you choose from those options, like, you will lose the game, aka you will die. And then you will learn that, you know, from the process of failing, that there were other options. And, you know, maybe because you're playing with the group, you see another player do it, and then you'll figure it out. And then the next time you play, you'll... And, like, that's how... I mean, I don't play dungeon games, but when I do play dungeon games, the difference between me and the people who play dungeon games is so stark, because they're like, yeah. I use the 10-foot pole. I tap as I go. If you didn't already know that the strategy is to use a 10-foot pole and tap as you go, like, it would not occur to you, right? So these games are kind of assuming that you learn your options from repeated play. And that's kind of chess as well. Like, it's not options and more strategy, right? Like,
yeah. So this is a thing that happens, that we see happen when a game develops a best strategy. We get a thing called heuristics. Like, we get mental shortcuts. And so you're right, in a dungeon, doing the 10-foot pole tippity tap, like looking for traps by poking ahead of you with a big stick, is a mental heuristic that like players have built up, right? No player is saying, oh, I have invented this new idea, or like, I've created a new thing. And in the same way, when chess world number one Magnus Carlsen sits down at a chessboard, for the first 20, 40 moves of a chess game, he's not analyzing it. He's not inventing it. He's performing habits. He's doing things that he knows to do. Oh, you played the Queen's Gambit. I play the Sicilian Defense. Oh, you played the Raconteur's Knightly. I play hippity hop to the corner shop. And like, these techniques get names, and they get like shortcutted. And this is the thing that we see happen as players get more and more familiar with their option sets, and those option sets start to like narrow into things that are good. And that's why 60% or whatever of people that play D&D 5e play variant humans. That's why, you know, the classic joke of the wizards having the, you know, do you have spell slots? Yes, then fireball flowchart. Like, if no, long rest and then fireball. Like, these things exist because these outcomes like become meaningfully better to the other players, right? Yeah. And that experience of like building heuristics, either as an individual player or as a community, as a culture, is a very real thing that happens in games. I think it depends very much about what kind of game you're playing, what kind of play experience you want, right? Like, I think, for example, Mothership is a game that's very okay with you bringing heuristics, because eventually it will end up with dice, and as soon as the dice get involved, you're in trouble. And so, like, the game kind of has this break glass in case of emergency that says, don't worry about the fact that players are just doing the same thing over and over, because eventually I'm going to throw this massive like stick in their spokes. Games like D&D, especially 5th edition, are much less resilient to heuristic play. And as soon as players have a habit, I love reading like RPG horror stories. I love it because it's like reading a real horror story. Like, my selection of players, the people I have an option to play with, are so cool, Thomas. And like, I include you in this. Like, you know, given we're in a lot of the same spaces, they're so cool that when someone's like, oh, this terrible person showed up at my table, it's the same as someone being like, I got attacked by a werewolf. Like, they're both not real to me. I just don't have to worry about it. It's awesome. So yeah, I love reading horror stories. And there's always these horror stories about, like, my players have found out that if you polymorph someone into a seahorse, then you can grapple them and put them in a bag of devouring, and then they die. And my players now have enough polymorph spells between them that, like, they can just do it. They just do it all the time. That's how they solve all their problems. And the gameplay experience shatters because the game's not resilient to that kind of heuristic play. And, you know, the reason that chess can work, the reason that heuristics work in chess is because you can only do it for 20 moves. There are more combinatorial positions on a chessboard than there are atoms in the universe or whatever. I don't know, some nerd shit. I don't know if I'm allowed to swear on your podcast. Okay, cool. Let's leave it then. Yeah, so, like, the reason that chess can work is because eventually you get to a period of the chessboard where it is so unique that no one in the world could have planned for that position and knows the solution to that position. But then what you'll see happen is players will go into a deeper analytical process where they're, like, inventing new solutions and going on that invent, consider, decide, act cycle. And then when they get down to enough pieces, they will go back to that way that we were talking about with, like, Sicilian defense and Queen's Gambit and stuff. They'll say, oh, this is a king bishop endgame. I can't win. Or, oh, we're in a rook queen endgame. I need to control the center of the board. And, like, they go back to heuristics because now we're within this space where it's comprehensible and where, like, we can hold that in our minds as players. And so I don't want to say to designers, don't design with heuristics, right? I don't want to say, like, don't have solutions that players can enact or whatever. What I want to say is, if that's all your game is, then it's not resilient to players picking best strategies because then every game looks the same. So instead, we create games that have some way of, like, breaking that heuristic open, that have some way of introducing new information or decreasing the strategy set or increasing the strategy set or, yeah, changing the meaning of stuff.
The thing that strikes me is this conversation sounds like it would apply to something like chess. But I would love to take it to a concrete example of a game that is probably as far from chess as we could go and, you know, still be talking about a game. So let's talk about one of your games and let's kind of analyze it with some of the concepts that we've discussed here. So
let's do it.
Like Decaying Orbit. Explain in the broadest terms how the game works. Like, first of all, it's GM-less. And that itself is a decision in who says what when, right? Because
correct.
There is a reason that the GM exists as a tool and a technology in games. And by going GM-less, you're already kind of, like, breaking away from that tradition. So yeah, tell me a little bit about Decaying Orbit and let's analyze it a little bit with the concepts that have come up today.
All right. I love that. So Decaying Orbit is a sci-fi storytelling game very much in the descended from the Queen tradition based on Alex Roberts' For the Queen. It is a card game in which we collectively, the players around the table, play an artificial intelligence that has awoken on a space station that has gone through some sort of crisis or calamity and has found itself on a decaying orbit, falling into the star AB Pictoris, the star that it orbits. There are a couple of things in there that will express or that will relate to, like, why it's GM-less. And I think that we can agree that one of the reasons the GM exists is to create a sense of authority for truth, right? The GM has the last say on the table, what happens around the table. This is a very, like, trad approach to GM authority. Or the GM plays the world so they can tell you what the world is or does or means. Yeah. So by removing that, one thing we remove is a sense of authority. And Decaying Orbit being about an artificial intelligence which is broken and being told through a set of shuffled cards is a game about incoherence and is a game about, like, things not quite matching up, things not quite being real or true or assertable in the same way. So the way the game works is you have a deck of cards. Those cards represent the rooms on a spaceship. There are four different spaceships that all have like special rooms for themselves. And you create a deck that is placed face down and no one knows the order. And you go through that deck exploring a room and you draw the first card and you say, the hangar in which we have, you know, the aircraft aboard this ship. And it will give you a description of the place while it is broken. And it will ask you to set a scene, to tell a story, to share your imagination of what the place looked like when people were in it and when it was functioning as a space station. And specifically to do that through the lens of what an artificial intelligence could find in their memory banks, looking back at this space. So Decaying Orbit was written for a friend of mine, or was written like for a lot of reasons, but one of the big ones was for a friend of mine who has aphantasia. She doesn't have the capacity to think in pictures in the same way that I do. I'm a very visual person. And so it's a game about getting away from that like visual first exploration of space and thinking about, in the greenhouse, one of the things that I would have is oxygen and moisture level detection. So I'm going to try and tell this story through the amount of oxygen and moisture in the air. And like, how do you do that? How do you express this tale with such like a limited avenue of expression? And so when we look through our lens of action paths and we say, well, players have limited ways of expressing themselves because they have to do it like an artificial intelligence would. And they don't really know what's going on because it's the first card. So what are players going to do? And the answer to that in the action paths framework is they're going to explore. They're going to treat it like a bit of a puzzle game. You know, they're going to start telling a story and figure out that it's not actually the story they want to tell. And they're going to go back a little bit and then start somewhere else. And they're going to like generate this internal incoherence with the tale. And then as players start to understand what the ship is, what it was doing, what the calamity was that caused the trouble, because as you get to a certain point in the deck, the next card is like, yep, and now we're not talking about when everything was functioning anymore. Now we're talking about the moment when everything went wrong. Players start to understand the ship and the environment and the situation, and they move out of exploration and into that sort of like analytical phase where they're trying to understand, and the stuff that they express is less like probing and much more trying to like put things into buckets so that they can, oh, well, this is the captain was over here where the giant plant was growing through the vent. But the first officer was over here where the alien was trying to get in through the exterior hatch. And so like they'll start to like build a story in this analytic way. And then when we get to the end and we now have very few rooms left and we now have these really strict requirements on what we're allowed to say as an artificial intelligence. And we have some things that are true or are like maybe true because we are a broken robot. So like the memory banks could be wrong. We get back into that heuristic phase. And now what we're doing is like tying things together and tying loops together. And players are like, well, I drew the greenhouse, so of course I have to tie this in with the giant plant that was growing through the vents. But I drew the solar panels, and that means of course I have to talk about the alien trying to get in from the outside where the solar panels are. And like, they naturally move through this beautiful three-act structure of like exploring, understanding, and then defining or concluding. And that's where using this kind of like action paths lens can help you find the play experience that you want players to have and that you want the like emotional resonance that you want generated as well.
Right. Okay. So a couple of things jump out at me. First is that for the Queen, I don't think this is a sentiment that I hear expressed often, but for the Queen does generate a kind of incoherent like narrative. Right? Like that's something correct that it does. So
yes,
what you're doing with Decaying Orbit is kind of taking advantage of one of the properties of the framework and then sort of like making that more, to use your language, delightful. Am I on the right track here?
Absolutely. One of the things that I do in my design approach is I look at how things are, because I'm a descriptivist, Thomas. I don't invent a thing to tell people how to play. I look at how things are being played, and then I make a game that supports that. And you're right. I think For the Queen generates an incredibly incoherent story, and a part of the core part of Decaying Orbit's design was, what if we took this thing that was a secondary effect of the game and we made it a primary effect?
And then going back to the idea of why this is a GM-less game, right? When we talk about the kind of trad model of GMing, the GM has to start the story, has to describe the setting, has to speak for the characters, has to end the story often. These are all things that we task the GM with. And For the Queen and Decaying Orbit just goes, oh yeah, the game will do all of those things. The game will start, the game will end, the game will describe the world, the game will, you know, there usually aren't any characters other than the players who can speak. So that we're just eliminating that. And then you get this extremely functional game that does away with the defining tech of RPGs, the GM, and flows really well.
I think you're entirely right. I think that it's important that we as indie people, right? This is called Yes Indeed, not Yes Tradded. And I think that it's important that we as indie people are respectful of the lineage of role-playing games and like the why. I see a lot of really reductive conversations that are like, 5th edition is a bad game with no redeeming features, and the only reason it's played is because it's popular, or because of like market dominance, or because of product market fit or whatever. And the reality is that that's not true, and that's not fair on the people that do play it. And there is truth in that statement, and the emotions behind that statement are probably more, you know, more accurate. Like the bitterness I can certainly vibe with. But like, GMs are a tool. GMs are there to do something. And so if you're going to take one away, you either need to reinforce those structures elsewhere by like creating pacing through your game, which is what I do in Decaying Orbit. I have specific Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. Or Spotlight, which is what For the Queen does, which is players take turns and then you ask questions and whatever. And that's Spotlight part of the GM's responsibility. But like, either way, if you're going to design games by inserting and removing mechanics and structures, then you need to understand what those mechanics and structures are doing and like why inserting and removing it is important.
So the way you explained your framework of action paths to think about the design of Decaying Orbit, okay, let me summarize what I heard from you, okay? When people start this game, they're uncertain, right? When people start any game, role-playing game specifically, you don't know who your characters are, you don't know what the world is, you don't know what actions you can take. You know, so there's a lot of uncertainty at the beginning, and so players play exploratively, tentatively. They're like trying to figure out like how any of this stuff works. And this is broadly true of like any game in RPG. Does that? I'm not sure whether your thoughtful demeanor is means I'm off track or you agree or disagree, because I was also then going to move to Act 2 and Act 3, but maybe we'll start with this.
Let's start in Act 1, because you're such a joy to talk to. This is fascinating. So I want to kind of reach into two things. One is like, when we start playing games, there are two types of starting. There is starting a new game, a new version, whatever, and there is starting as a new player, and both of those are very different experiences.
Okay.
So which one are we talking about, starting like as a brand new fresh player to a game, or are we talking about like, I played so much D&D 5e, now let's play a new campaign?
I'm talking about someone who is playing a game for the first time. They've played other games before, but like in this situation, I'm imagining like a game for, they don't know how the rules work yet.
Right. Yeah. So this is really interesting, because one of the things you said players do is they play tentatively. And that is true sometimes, but not always. Yeah. I would recommend, if you have a chance, take a puzzle game that you know well, like a digital puzzle game, go on YouTube and watch someone else play it. And what you'll find in a very well-designed puzzle game is that when a player doesn't know what to do in any game space, they will start to try and generate some degree of certainty by a different method. And in some games, that method is by doing stuff. And in some games, that method is by asking questions. And in some games, that method is, you know, different. And so the way that a game helps players build certainty is critical to whether or not they'll play tentatively or not. An example I really like is there's a game called Snake Bird. It's a digital game. You are a bird that moves like the snake from Snake, the old like phone game Snake. So you move at like right angles and you have to collect fruit and whatever. And when you start that game and you know nothing about it, you can't learn anything by staring at the screen. You can't learn anything by like watching the game in an idle state.
Yeah.
You have to start playing. And so you don't play tentatively. Instead, you just start going in directions. You just start doing things because every time you act, the game provides you feedback, right? We're going to loop back into this. Agency, feedback, delight. We're back in this loop again, right?
Yeah.
Do a thing, learn a thing, fun experience, joyful experience. So the reason players will often play tentatively in games is because the way that they get information is by being tentative. And consequences are really big and really difficult to like do something about, right? So Snake Bird has an undo button. So when you die, you just undo a move and you lose seconds. When you play a game like Blades in the Dark, it says jump to the action and start doing things. That's what it wants you to do. And the way that it does that is the way to learn the most about a thing in Blades in the Dark is to say to the GM, I do it. And they will say to you, that is desperate and limited. And in that interaction, you have learnt. And now you can start going back on that exploratory path, right? And being like, oh, it's desperate and limited, but what if I have a gun? And they'll be like, no, that's desperate and still limited. And you're like, oh, so it's not about gun. What if I have a bunch of people? What if I, and like you can, you can start to probe at the edges of why that game is defined that way.
Yeah.
In Apocalypse World Second Edition, to generate certainty, you read a situation. And when you read a situation, all of your outcomes are like, how do I kill someone? Who has something that I want so I can kill them? I have just killed someone. How do I get out of this position in which I have killed someone? And the game kind of like drives you to generate certainty on the destabilizing violence side. The reason we see tentative play in things like the OSR, where people are tapping around with 10-foot poles, or in D&D, where people are like making insight rolls, perception rolls all the time or whatever, is because those games both have a very, like, I'm gonna use some value judgment words, but I do want this to like come from a place of respect for those designers and those works. But like Mothership has a very poor way for players to extract information from the GM to generate certainty, which means that they have to play tentative because they don't understand the world around them. A really interesting, I think, like trad example is if we look at Call of Cthulhu 7th edition, when you look at your sheet, someone will have like library use 70, someone will have like lore 80, someone will have like all of these information getting skills are really high, and there's very, very little risk to them. So players are just empowered to like, I go to the central records hall, I go to the scene of the crime and I ask the police about things, and they don't get tentative until the like act two, act three of the game, when all of a sudden there are ghosts and like, now I don't have the tools, now I don't have the certainty, now I don't have like ways to be certain, because mythos and like, you know, uncertainty is kind of part of the vibe. And so I think we start sessions as new players exploring, desperately trying to use like the action paths words, definitely desperately trying to orient ourselves to the world around us, and that the ways in which we can orient ourselves show us what we do.
When I said tentative, I mean that, and I don't know if I'm disagreeing with you or not, but sticking with just RPGs, there's always a sort of tentativeness I feel in the beginning, because when you're exploring, as you would put it, when you're engaging with things for the first time, like the confidence you have that you're not messing up, you know, like even in even in decaying orbit, right? Why I would say that you'd start this game tentatively is because you're like, once I say a thing, it's set. I think that most people are going to start out playing this game, trying to make small moves that are low risk, and not risk in terms of their character might die, but low risk, like social risk of like, I'm going to say a thing that now everyone has to live with. And, you know, they're going to be like, why do you say that? Like, you know, to avoid the kind of awkwardness of that. So that's what I mean by like, there is a kind of social exploration of like, okay. So, you know, what do you want to do? What do I want to do? And we're kind of figuring this out. So I think kind of to some extent, like all RPGs, if the system is new to you and you don't know that, if I ask a question, the GM says, you're going to roll library use, and then you're just going to know the answer. If I don't know that, it's just so straightforward and so low risk, like I'm going to be kind of tentative about it, is what I was going for. But does that make sense?
It really does. And I think that the reason for that is that we're actually very bad at designing the first experience in role-playing games. There's a concept, right, in mobile games, which is like where I do my 9-to-5, called the first time user experience for 2E, FTUE, first time user experience. That concept basically says that like we need to consider and design for the first time a player touches this game. We need to understand that they're gonna, as you said, be tentative. They're not gonna know what's available to them. They're not gonna know the risk, whether that risk is social risk or perceived character risk or whatever, or financial risk, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What we're going to do is create a system that onboards the player through that high risk period. And we in RPGs very broadly have just offloaded that to the GM or to table culture or to a line in text that says like, you know, put the X card there and then everything's fine. And then you don't have social risk anymore, a whole thing. So I'm very clear that I think we should create better first-time user experiences in games, right? It's my least favorite thing about Blades in the Dark.
Okay.
Because it's such a complex game to just put in front of people for the first session. The character sheet has a lot of text on it. Like, things are really difficult. And we tutorialize very poorly in role-playing games. And I want to fix that and I want to design new methods and whatever, but like, I can't blame anyone that says like the social system works and social play is a part of role-playing games. So like, why don't we just offload it to them? Why don't we just expect that the GM has watched an actual play video? Or why don't we just, you know, expect that they've picked it up from some sort of external source? Maybe that is the answer. Like, maybe that is the best way to do it. But my dream when I think about putting a game in front of someone is how do I help them move as quickly as possible through that sense of risk, of real risk, and move them through that into a position of confidence where they can engage with the systems of the game.
100%. I think RPGs do a poor job of tutorializing. I think that's like, yeah, really safe of any to have. But I think the reason that they continue to not have to change that. You know, I think about the design for manual cars, and like, I think when you first learn how to drive a car like that, you have this experience of like, oh, I start the car by pushing the clutch down, and then I release it to make the car go. Like, why am I taking my leg off something to make it go forward? That's really weird. And it is like a thing that I think everybody who has learned how to drive like has this experience of like, that was really weird. And then because everyone kind of figures it out, like cars didn't change for so long because they're like, it is weird, but yeah, people figure it out and go on with their lives. And I feel like with RPGs, it's like that.
Absolutely. And it is full of a bunch of assumptions about like what is our actual goal and what do we want to achieve, and like yes there are a bunch of people who learn games, but how many people, and I don't know this number, but how many people do you think play D&D for the first time and go, oh, that was actually an unpleasant experience, or I didn't feel confident or whatever, and I'm just never going to touch it again. Or read the book and go, I don't want to do that. I actually think this happens more on the GMing side than it happens on the play side, because GMs don't have a GM there to like do that social easing, right? And so this is what we would call in design like a local maxima problem, which is that we found this position that looks good because doing it any worse is going to have more people fall off, and doing it any better is a really hard design problem to solve that's really expensive to solve, right? Which is why cars are still the way they are, right? Because it would cost to redesign in some way. And so we've reached this
because
like local
the people
maximum.
That you want to sell new cars to have already learned how to do it and therefore don't care, you know?
Right, right.
Every person who has to learn for the first time goes through that same painful experience. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so if you want to write a Powered by the Apocalypse game and your audience is people who have already played and are comfortable with Powered by the Apocalypse games, fine. Like, don't have a first-time user experience. That's fine. If you want your audience to be that plus one, you need a way to teach the game.
Okay. So going back to Action Paths and Decaying Orbit. Okay. So we start out exploring. And then after that, in the middle act of Decaying Orbit, like the idea is that we understand the game, we understand the space a little bit, we understand the world, the fiction, the story. And now we will act more confidently. We're going to start thinking about what we want and we'll know how to achieve it. And so like this is the phase of the game where people are going to make big moves. And
yeah.
Does that make sense? Yeah.
Yep. So this switch happens at a stage of Decaying Orbit where players draw the Act 2 card. Act 1 says, we're going to explore these rooms as they were when the ship was functioning. And what that means is you don't have to make a big move. This is the medical bay. Someone comes in. They get, you know, we can tell this story of one person in the medical bay. Or we can say, this is the medical bay. We look through our records. It seems that there were several healthcare workers here and lots of people being seen to, and then they all of a sudden files stop being signed by one doctor and they stop being signed by another doctor, and now there's only one doctor and they're, you know, their file, there aren't as any files or whatever.
You can say something new and cool and interesting and exciting, but you can also say the obvious thing and it'll be fine. Like this.
Exactly.
You can just, like, this, it works perfectly fine.
Yeah. So just say the obvious thing. Take us through a day, like day in the life sort of stuff. Do what you want to do. That's Act 1. And then Act 2 says, now every time you draw a room, make a big move. This is why things broke. This is the problem. Our ship is broken. Everyone is dead. No one is left on board. Tell me why. And this is where you're going to, start making moves. You're going to start blowing holes in the side of the ship. You're going to start launching people through airlocks. You're going to start revealing that people are alien infiltrators that can shapeshift. Like, it's when you're going to start making big moves. And the freedom to do that comes from the, like, both the social cachet that you've built over the past, you know, two rounds of telling vibe stories to each other, and the orientation to both the space and the game. And then all of this is coded, of course, with a big card on the table that says, like, this memory is corrupted, which has probably been used a couple of times in that first phase to be like, I don't really want to answer a question, so I'm just going to say that, like, yeah, and this memory is corrupted, and we don't know any more about it. Or is going to be used, I say, like, against, but, like, pleasantly against other players in, like, that playful antagonism of, like, oh, and then we see who logged into the computer system last, and it was, and someone would be like, ah, no, that memory's corrupted. We can't tell which crew member that was. And it builds in this inherent safety net of, I know that I can just say stuff, and I can start to assert some really crazy stuff, and that my players who love me and want incoherence and explicitly want this to be like a weird space story are going to stop me from being able to assert specifics by, like, corrupting the memory in different places and that sort of thing. You know, I'm going to say the person comes in through the airlock and the gases escape from their helmet. And as they pull off in the grainy black and white security camera, we see their face and someone will be like, no, that memory is corrupted. And that's the like safety net that I'm allowed to go as hard as I want. And people will tug on my leash when they're ready.
Yeah, so the way the game is facilitating moving from, say, small things, like get your bearings to like say big things and like let's have some dramatic events occur is you know, the types of questions you're asking, like that kind of changes from act one to act two, right? That's why those acts exist, is because you want to facilitate a change in mode of play, right?
Exactly. There's no better way for me to say it than that. That's such a perfect expression of why that act break exists. Because you'll see in, for the Queen games, and this again is that like descriptivist approach to game design. This is a thing that I have seen in playing for the Queen, and so a thing that I'm going to sort of take with me, is that players will be eager to make moves or have things be dramatic or like to have scenes have more impact, and they might not have the tools available to them to do that, either because they don't feel like the cards they're drawing are dramatically impactful enough, or because they don't feel like they have a creative idea on how they want something to be super dramatic. And that's this is very clearly not a value judgment saying that, and therefore like Decaying Orbit is better than Jesus, is better than For the Queen. Nobody out there clip that. Alex will come after me. I'm in the same country as her now. She can do it. What it is me saying is like Decaying Orbit wants to be much more intentional about that switch in modality of play, where For the Queen wants to leave space for players to explore that switch in modality of play.
Yeah, yeah. I have definitely had games of For the Queen where like a question would have elicited a much more juicier response from a player if it had come a little bit later. It came a bit too early. It's such a good question, but it just came a bit too early. Okay, so let's talk about how the game ends. Now, my understanding of games in general is that people want a nice ending. The thing is, Decaying Orbit has the cool ending like from the start. Like we know, we know how it's going to end in a kind of like, like we started with the ending. So like given that we got the most important piece of the puzzle, like what else do you change about how like people interact in Act 3? What are you facilitating there?
This is such a good question, because I don't think I've ever said this out loud. Like I don't think this has ever made it to text. I don't think it's ever been discussed in a recorded conversation. So we're kind of, you're getting a bit of a scoop on this one. The Act 2 card is placed halfway in the deck, and the Act 3 card is the last card on the deck. What this means is that half of the game, roughly half, it's people tend to make shorter scenes really early and make longer scenes later. So like somewhere between, half and a third of the game is Act 1, is where exploring this space. Somewhere between half and two thirds of the game is Act 2, which is the make dramatic big moves. The actual ending of the game is about 30 seconds. It's really short. Act 3 is tiny. And the reason that Act 3 is tiny is that, you're right, we already know what's happening, which is the ship's falling into the thing. The other thing is that Act 3 is about conclusions and wrapping up, and players want to like tie up loose ends, and players want stuff to make sense. And Decaying Orbit is incredibly resistant to that. And so I am going to give you no time to make sense of this. Wait. You said that the captain was in the bridge when the laser was fired, but in the other one, he's down in the protein mill feeding like bodies into the wood chipper. And like, how does this make sense? And the game says, that memory's corrupted. You have 30 seconds to do Act 3. Get the fuck off my table. Okay, now here's the real scoop. Everything I just said, lies. Lies and falsities and untruths. The actual Act 3 of the game is about a week long, because what happens is the next day you're in the shower and you're like, was the captain an alien shapeshifter the whole time, and we just never figured that out? And like it persists. It sits in your brain. It gets turned over. And it does that in the same way that ambiguous endings in film, theatre, all that sort of stuff, are designed to force people to think about the game through a metaphorical or a thematic lens, right? When Christopher Nolan's Inception ends and thing is spinning, and we know that if it falls over, it means that he's in the real world, and if it doesn't, it means it's in his dream. When that cuts before we get the answer, what that is doing is it's the film saying to us, it doesn't actually matter what the reality is. What matters is, like, what's your thematic interpretation of the metaphor that we've set up about, like dreams and that sort of stuff. And in the same way, Decaying Orbit says, you get to send a transmission, you get to, like, say your last thing, you get to do your epilogue, and you get to do that because otherwise players would have a coup and I would be accosted in my own home. So it lets you have the epilogue, but it doesn't actually let that epilogue mean anything, because it's going to invite you to keep playing it, you know, a week later when you think about that scene of you know, the navigator and the engineer kissing in the greenhouse that was told entirely through their heart rate monitors and the amount of oxygen and moisture in the air. And it's going to beg you to, like, explore that and for it to mean something in your head and your life and to take up space for a little bit longer. The act of concluding, of closure, of wrapping everything up is a really nice thing to have in stories. But just like a GM, it's a tool. And we can play GMless if we want to. And we can play closureless if we want to.
Yep. That's really good. I think that is really cool. Yeah. Again, everything is sort of coming back to this embrace of incoherence and turning it into an advantage.
Like the embrace of the play culture as well, right? A big part of descriptivism is that you can capture what people are doing, what emergent behaviors are happening, and you can bottle them. Yeah. And I couldn't tell you how many times I've played a role-playing game with someone and then a week later I get a text from them and it's like, hey, wouldn't it have been cool if this other thing happened? Or, like, what if my character and your character meet up afterwards and become bounty hunters together? And I'm like, yeah, like, this is all cool. This is all play. This is all part of play. Yeah. But why doesn't the game have a tool for me to, like, explore that in some way? Or, like, why isn't the game intentional about us exploring that in some way?
I think we did what I wanted to do, which is that I think we took this kind of theoretical conversation that we had, which I was worried that it was getting so theoretical and was using kind of language about games, because we were using examples like chess and stuff like that seemed so far away from not only the games that I play, but the games you design. And I just wanted to kind of bring us back to that. And I think we did that. And I think it was really cool. I think the kind of analysis of Decaying Orbit was super fun. I think your kind of design and the choices you made and I think you've convinced me, but and probably hopefully listeners as well, that like Action Fast is not just theory or whatever, like, you know, whatever, just in quotes, like, you know, it is supposed to be a kind of applied framework.
Yeah, I very much consider myself a door kicker, right? I very much consider myself as someone who wants to break down barriers between conceptual buckets. So, like, I'm not just a PBTA player. I'm not just an indie player. I play OSR, I play Trad, I do all that sort of stuff. I'm not just an academic or just industry. I work in industry and I try and like read a bunch of research and publish research when I can. And I don't think things are just theoretical or like just practical applications with no theory behind them. I think that it's all a bit of everything.
So before we get into the standard questions, Sydney, what are you working on these days? What's the next thing that we can expect you to release?
The next project you'll see from me is called The Most Dangerous Game. It is a game about a monster and a monster hunter in a cat and mouse game where we each have like a choose your own adventure book, and the monster hunter tries to hunt the monster and the monster tries to kill the monster hunter. the thing that I want, like the hook that I want to offer people is, we were speaking before about how you let people assert things says a lot about what, like, what you believe in the world, or like about power and about your philosophy on game design and human interaction. The nature of Most Dangerous Game is that the person who acts as the GM, the person who has authority to say kind of what happens next from a pacing perspective, is the prey. And the person who acts as the player, who gets to just like say what they do and let someone else move it into mechanics, is the predator. And so, Thomas, when your werewolf leaps from the bushes, teeth bared, to strike me in the throat, I'm the one who decides whether you just kill me, we get into a tussle, or like you miss. And that decision falls on like me as the disempowered, which means that I'm gonna, the framing of the game is make them earn your blood. You jump from the bushes? No, I throw you down. You tear my arm off? Not good enough. Like, I keep fighting. You know, you're going to have to kill me, and I'm going to make you kill me in a way that makes my like death meaningful and worthwhile. I will not go gently into that good night. And so, yeah, the Most Dangerous Game is about trading off who's the predator and who's the prey, and looking your friend in the eye and telling them, if you want to kill me, like, you're going to have to fucking take it.
I know this game because of things we said before we hit recording, that this is based on Murderous Ghosts. And I remember very clearly the Hard Move episode about Murderous Ghosts, where you described a game of Murderous Ghosts that you had played, and the word you used was edging. And I think I remember it was John Harper on the other side who just had this sort of like visceral reaction to me, like, oh, I can't believe you said that.
Look, I'm certainly not the first person to say that good role-playing and good BDSM are born in the same crucible. I'm definitely not the first person to say that, but I will say that a lot of people come to that conclusion independently because there's something to it. And this game is like good bottoming the game. And, you know, if that makes one more person pick it up than before.
Thanks so much, Sydney. I think we're going to get into the standard questions that I ask everyone who comes on my show. In a section called Infectious Enthusiasm, I ask, what's a game that you've had a lot of fun with and you want to recommend?
I want to recommend Jex Thomas's Bump in the Dark, which is Forge in the Dark, Monster of the Week, you know, Buffy, Forge in the Dark. Aesthetically, it's a really good presentation of the theme. I think that it gets closer to those Monster of the Week shows than like the PBTA approaches to it did. They're like a little bit more breakneck. This just has a better control of pacing. It sees so much of what Blades in the Dark does and then applies it to a different genre in a really excellent way. And then it does some of those things that a hack should do, which is it has fun new mechanical interactions, and like GMs have a currency in a really strong, interesting way. The engagement role gets reframed as a showdown role, and it's different. It's got a bigger focus on investigation rather than on like the score. It's just, it is exactly what this era of hack for Forge in the Dark should be. And it's also just a really fun game.
I've played Bump in the Dark.
Awesome.
I was in a I don't know how early it was, but I was in a game that Jex Thomas ran, and that was fun.
So Bump in the Dark is getting a revised edition through Backer Kit in June, which means that when your listeners hear this, they should be able to go to like Google it, Bump in the Dark Backer Kit, and hit the like let me know when this starts, because it's going to be a great edition.
I'll try and link it in the show notes, folks. Okay, in the next section, Tyranny of Numbers, I ask, what is a number or statistic that you can share from your work that you think will be useful to others?
I want to put numbers to what we were talking about before when it comes to you know, how many players play their first session and then never play again, or how many people do we sort of lose that could love RPGs, but they're a little bit too arcane. And so these numbers are 50, 25, 15, and 4. And in mobile game design, they are the number of people who have downloaded your game who are still playing it after 1 day, 7 days, 14 days, and 30 days. So after 1 day of playing your game, you will lose 50% of your audience. If your game is a market leader, if it is excellent, half of the people will still be playing. After a week, a quarter of the people will be playing. By the time you get to a month, 4% of people who touched your game will still be touching it. That is a humbling statistic, and also a reminder to myself constantly that we need to be clear about like who our audience is. We need to be very intentional about what our first sessions look like, because that's where the most people are seeing the game. And that we need to do everything that we can to make it easy for people to stay around and like rewarding for them to stay around.
Sort of follow-up question. What do you think about in general, like the idea of the fact that many people's first session is going to be like a session zero where they make character?
Yeah. Great question. It's difficult because it depends on what like your culture of play is, I guess. When people play trad games, very often, they're coming with an idea of what character they want to play. And so they've already kind of been playing, engaging with the system for so long. But like one of the reasons that Apocalypse World pops so much is because you can give someone a play sheet they tick off. Like Urban Shadow is a really, really good example for this. Yeah. You can give people a play sheet, they can like tick off two things on it, and then you can just start playing.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have a session zero. The like consent and safety and like structuring side, you don't have to have a session zero where you like teach people how to play the game or build characters together or whatever. You just do it. Or like the alternative method that trad games like Traveller use is that session zero is super fun. Like building a character using that life path system is super fun.
Yeah.
And you roll a bunch of dice and you feel active and you make decisions. And so I think like, yeah, absolutely have your first character creation thing be an act of play, not an adjunct to play.
That is a great answer. Thank you. Okay. In the next section titled Replay, I ask, is there a story or anecdote that you've heard about someone else playing your game that you would like to share?
Just after Decaying Orbit had released, I got a phone call from my mum, and she, my father, and my dad's like brother and sister and their partners had decided to play Decaying Orbit. And they were, I think I can like fairly say, some of the drunkest people I have ever heard on a phone call. And just listening to them try and narrate this like act three resolution thing to me, and they were laughing and like talking over each other and, you know, corrupting memories and interjecting, and just like it was this beautiful act of play from 7 60-plus-year-olds who have never played a role-playing game and like would have never played a role-playing game were my name not on it. And to hear them not only like play Decaying Orbit, but also to like get it, like to play it right in that very social, free-formy kind of way, just meant the world to me.
Wow, that is lovely. That is the reason I asked this question, is to hear stories like that. Thank you so much. Okay, my last question. In a section called All Advice is Advice for Myself, I ask, what's a habit or technique that you are trying to get better at your table?
I'm probably one of the worst people in the world at like letting subtext exist. I learned how to GM off games like Dogs in the Vineyard and Apocalypse World Second Edition and stuff, which are like, just scream stuff at your players. Just tell them. Just like, hide nothing. You have no secrets. Tell them that people are lying. Tell them the... And I have been trying so hard to like sit myself more in that way of like expressing what's happening in the narrative and in the world and in the diegesis without then telling them like what the conclusion is or what that means. And like Decaying Orbit's a great game for that, right? Because people will ask you questions about hey, I thought you said the captain was over here, what happened? And the only way you're allowed to answer it in that game is through the lens of the AI. You're not allowed to tell people what the conclusion is. You have to say, oh yeah, no, there's two captains, his biosignals are in two locations at once. And like people have to kind of figure out what that means. And I'm really bad at that. So I'm trying to get better at telling my Blades in the Dark crews that you know, they've heard rumors without like immediately confirming what all that subtext is meant to mean in the act of play.
That's good, because I think that Dogs in the Vineyard and Apocalypse World advice is completely correct in a sense, but I don't think the goal of that advice was to be like, so now you can't have subtext.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I think it goes back to the same thing we said before, like that clarification, that GM over the screen clarification is a tool. And when you remove it from play, you get a different type of play, and that's awesome. And we just need to, well, I say we to drag people down with me. I certainly need to be better at knowing when to pull that trigger and when to like let players understand the world on their own terms.
Awesome. I think, you know, in some sense, that sentiment is full circle back to almost the first thing we talked about, which is this idea of, you know, what should the game do and when should it throw to the players and making space for them because this is their game. So yeah, thanks so much, Sydney. This was really nice to sit and talk to you about all of this stuff. And hopefully I can edit it down and get it released on time. But
I'm so sorry. No, this was an absolute pleasure. You are fantastic. I've enjoyed both listening to your work as a disembodied listener and also like sharing space with you on Slack and stuff like that. I'm just so glad that you're around, that you're doing the work that you are, that you're approaching it the way that you are. Yeah, I think that we're all much richer for having you ask the questions that you ask.
Thank you so much. Is there a website or a social media link you want to point my listeners to that I can link in the show notes, which I definitely will?
Yeah. Waxwings.com.au is the best place. I'm on Discord and Twitter and Blue Sky and all that sort of stuff. But like the fractured nature of community is such that if you want to reach out to me there. Yeah, I have a newsletter. It'll be where you see all my new stuff coming out. Waxwings.com.au.
Hope you enjoyed that episode, folks. Links to everything in the description. Next week, this podcast is on break because I'll be traveling and I do not have something to schedule right now. Yeah, I will put something from the Patreon feed onto the general episode feed, something from the best of 2023 Patreon episodes. Till then, as always, hope you have a lovely day. And does Indy need you? Yes, indeed.
And cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's sulfur, californium and fermium, berkelium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium, and argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium, and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the only ones of which the news has come to Harvard. And there may be many others, but they haven't been discovered.